Then this is, let's see, the 11th class I've led on this book, The Intimate Way of Zen by James Ishmael Ford, one of my Dharma uncles. Although there's been two other classes that Sangha members have led. So we've been working on it for quite a while. I think it's just one more class after this. And I'm just going to share and review the 10 oxygenating pictures, which is what this book follows along with. So these pictures have been around for hundreds of years. They were created by Chan or Zen teacher in China, and they describe the spiritual path. So the ox, meaning, our heart's desire, enlightenment, awakening, liberation, however you want to describe kind of the goal of your spiritual practice. And at first, we are just searching for the ox. Then find the footprints. Then we catch a glimpse of the ox. Then we manage to catch the ox, but it's still kind of struggling and iffy, right? Then we tame the ox. Then we are riding home on the ox. Then we are at home, the ox forgotten, the self remains. Then the one that we're talking about tonight, forget both self and ox. And that circle is an enso. It's a Zen symbol calligraphy drawing. And it's usually, when it's done by calligraphy like that, it's just done with one breath. So they put the brush down on the page and just draw that circle. And it's, unending symbol of emptiness. We all have one on the wall over there. Then we have two more. Maybe we have two more classes after this. Anyway, so then there's return to the origin, back to the source, and then entering the marketplace with extended hands. So even what we talk about tonight is not the end of the path. So this eighth oxygen picture, this enso, each picture has a poem along with it. The poem for this one is Whip, Hope, Self, Ox, No Traces Left. Thoughts cannot penetrate the vast blue sky. Snowflakes cannot survive a red hot stove. Arriving here, meet the ancient teachers. So why do we talk about these later stages of practice? I think we can all relate to the first few pictures of the ox herding pictures, looking, seeking something, kind of getting a sense of it, catching glimpses of it, sometimes catching it. It gets away from us again, so you can relate to that. So we talk about these later stages of practice, at least on occasion, in part for two reasons, really. In part because these pictures can describe our overall arc of practice throughout our life. But they also can describe really our relationship to insight, like insight and liberation over and over. We can be searching for something, kind of start to find it, get a sense of it, get a hold of it, build a relationship with it, and then it becomes natural, and then we kind of forget about it, right? So in a way, we all experience all these steps over and over as we develop insight and understanding about our lives. But it's also important, if in that sense of our whole life of practice, that even if this is something maybe that like we're not going to experience for a long time, or it seems kind of way beyond our current practice, it's helpful to just have a sense of where we are going, right? To have a map, like we understand, well, okay, it goes this far. Maybe avoid certain pitfalls, or maybe kind of, oh, right, this is I recognize this. This is where I'm supposed to be. So it's helpful to hear about what the path looks like. So more about this particular. So James Ford opened this chapter that started on this eighth picture with a story about told by his teacher, John Tarrant, who he was attending his mother's deathbed. I know it turned out like I think she got better, but anyway, she was, at death, very, very, very sick. And he says, John, his sister, and their father sat with their mother through the night and into the next day. People came and went, things were said. Whenever John wanted the experience to be different, pain opened up. Floods of words from the past poured in. Memories of choices made and not made, and of the consequences that followed. He watched himself as he thought about how things should be, including how people should be acting, his sister, his father, his mother, himself. Then he opened himself up to what it might be like if he just let things happen. In a heartbeat, he claimed his place beyond choosing and rejecting. This was a gift from the ancient times, from John's own path and mine, and perhaps yours. For him, it was the place he had found and could still touch. Any of us can try to find this place of just letting go, just letting be. We can certainly capture at least a hint of that release. It can be part of an ongoing spiritual discipline. And in some ways, it is close to the heart of what Zazen, seated Zen meditation, looks like. The most important thing is that this is more than a thought experiment. This is an experience experiment. And it is a central part of the intimate way, a great fulcrum in our lives, with a before and a rather different after. It turns out, after finding many wonderful things, after falling into innumerable wells, after finding oneself in the light of that brightness greater than a thousand suns, or if you prefer, that darkness darker than a thousand nights, we even lose that self that recognizes the mystery. A great blessing, this. Here all our words fail. The ox herding pictures display this stage as an empty circle. In Japanese Zen, this circle is called the Enso. The Enso is most commonly rendered by a single brush stroke. It can be open, it can be closed. It might be a perfect circle, but probably not. And this is important. The Enso, though a symbol, is no mere abstraction. The words, the symbols, they point to where we might stand. At some point on the intimate way, if we persist, if we're just a little lucky, we come to this place. So no trace remains. Even after our insight, Even after perhaps we have a taste of the various ways that we describe reality with a capital R, emptiness, suchness, Buddha nature, all of that also disappears. And this may seem like an obscure teaching to talk about stuff disappearing before you even feel like you have tasted it. But consider the alternative. If we talked about these things, we talked about these things that we awaken to as things, and now you have it. I understand emptiness. You don't understand emptiness. Maybe next week you'll understand emptiness, and then we can like, it's a thing. It's a thing that we attain. When that's not how it is. So it'd be very different if we talked about these things as really discrete and kind of permanent attainments. When we say, in the meantime, we talk about these things, we talk about these concepts, and they are helpful until we let them go. So up until the last moment, there is self and ox and this practice and this struggle and this. And then at a certain point, we let that go. We think about trying to, what it means to try to have an experience of emptiness, non-separation, suchness. It means no duality. So there can't be an I here who wants to experience that. Like you, that has to be surrendered. In order to have the experience, you have to surrender the effort to have the experience, the identification of the experience. The wanting the experience. That's just the way it is. This is why our, the Heart Sutra, one of the things that we chant regularly, says, it talks about that ultimately things are not, do not exist the way that we think they do. And well, that's the Makahara Mita-Shingyo. Let's see. Let's There we go. So it's saying the body's empty, sensations are empty, perceptions, consciousness, all of this. Okay. I mean, can at least accept that as a theory. All dharmas are marked by emptiness, no realm of sight, and all that. But then it gets down to there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death, da 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 da. Now, that is one of the original Buddhist teachings, the 12-fold chain of dependent emergence. Like it's the kind of Buddhist theory of like, well, how does all this, how do we get into this mess anyway, to begin with? And it's saying that that fundamental teaching also is empty. No cause, no suffering. Okay, so these are the Four Noble Truths saying there's no dukkha, there's no cessation of dukkha, there's no path, no knowledge, no attainment. Even these things are empty of inherent existence. So I think that's pretty radical that we belong to a path that says from the beginning, and all of our fundamental teachings are also empty. They're also not inherently existent, right? We employ them as far as they are useful, but they're nothing that we can grasp permanently, and that's not the point. What if all those things don't exist? Should it's, I mean, we shouldn't bother. We shouldn't even be seeking the ox. I mean, if the ox doesn't really exist. What does that really even mean? I mean, that means it's very subtle. The ox is real up until the last moment. Then we take the next step and all the dualities dissolve. And this happens in our direct experience. At first, it happens only for a moment here and there. But those moments are transformative. And there is still more integration to be done. I mean, there's two more ox herding pictures, right? That you might figure, if you're sitting there, that your body's still there. And if we talk about letting go of self, right? So that you can experience non-duality, then in a sense, you are still there. You're just like letting go of the idea of self. So in a sense, you're there, but it's a mental state you're getting into, a non-dual mental state. But what you actually realize is that the you is a construct of your own mind. So it really is gone. That you really is gone for a moment, and long enough for you to see that it's not real. The you, in exactly the sense you usually think of yourself as being, is absent. And this may sound terrifying, and it can be disorienting, but it is liberating. What else is left? At that moment where we've managed to totally let go. Everything is left. It's not what you thought it was, but everything is left. Things don't work the way you think they do, but everything is flowing on just fine, the way it always has been, all along, right? There is no fixed ground on which to stand, but nonetheless, you can stand. So it's good to know from the very beginning that all of your most precious Dharma teachings, practices, concepts, insights, etc., are also empty, even if you're not sure exactly what that means. It means you are prepared once you reach that point. When you cross the river, you can put down the raft, right? It's fine, like to make an effort right up. And if we didn't make an effort at all, nothing would happen. Our practice would not come to fruition. We make an effort. Somebody like says, like, you don't really exist the way you think you do. Even if you're striving for enlightenment, you're just, getting in your own way. Just like, well, but what am I, but I mean, what else are we supposed to do? We make that effort until we, I don't know, it's like almost through trial and error. I mean, try something and it's like, oh, okay, I can let that go. So in terms of all of this, like, I've been fond at times of asking people to reflect on experiences they've had, essentially of, kind of non-dual moments of just, seeing things, being with things or people or whatever, where the self kind of drops away and, things just look kind of bright and complete, stuff like that. To make the point in a way that we all have experienced this, because it's the way in which that in way in which we have, and yet we have not. If we emphasize the you have not experienced this yet too much, then we get into like now we've kind of concretized something we want to attain. We don't have it. We are telling a story about it, right? And now it's this thing, and what is it? And I'll hopefully I can get it when I go to the next retreat. Something like that, right? So don't want to emphasize that too much. Because it ends up being right in our own direct experience. On the other hand, it is something that there's a reason why in Zen we have a tradition of, multiple day retreats. Because it takes a while to calm the mind, to taste the stillness, to open up. To just like, what is this moment? What is this life? It's a very open and receptive way, which allows us to experience this other kind of being, other way of being. So, before I go on to the next chapter, leave that there for any kind of questions or reflections. Rina.
Yeah, I was thinking about did I experience that or not? And then you were talking about multi-days retreats when you're sitting, and I'm like, no, I definitely didn't feel that there, but I felt it actually. That's what I thought in my ordinary life, with interactions with people that are so dear to me in ways that it's kind of dawned on me that the emptiness, like it was like either pure joy or pure acceptance of of connection in a moment that had it had no history and it had no future. And all that didn't matter. It was just right there, with very, very powerful experience that happened to me more and more. After after it happens once, it happens more. But it's definitely not happening when I'm sitting. When I'm sitting, my mind keep wander. So I'm kind of like, is that it or is that not it? I don't know.
Well, it makes me think that, there's a reason why Ford started this chapter with that story, of his teacher being with his mother while dying and just kind of because of that situation, just reaching to a space of not choosing and rejecting, of just really just being. And in terms of, have you done a multiple day like retreat?
I did with you a year and a half
Oh
ago.
yeah. Were
Or
you there for the whole thing?
no, I think 3 days or nights. Yeah.
Yeah,
It
I mean,
was so difficult.
it's not
I
an
needed
easy
to go to
thing.
run in the middle. I went to you and I'm like, I feel like I need to go jogging. And I feel like it's wrong.
It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. I mean, it's like I mean, do session after session after session, and it takes a while to learn, what is it we are supposed to be doing on the cushion, right? I feel like I'm still learning how to do zazen, right? Sometimes I'll still like, I don't know, kind of happen upon a new way of kind of letting go, and I'll be like, oh, that's what just sitting is. Oh, so it can take a while, but it's, I don't want to say, I also think that the sitting that we do, even the sitting that we do in retreat, even if it doesn't feel all that deep and profound and still, is having an effect on us and can kind of prime us and make us more able to do the kind of thing that you were talking about.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, I can see the correlation. Yeah.
But when you do manage to, because it takes, you have to learn how to sit deeply. You want to learn how to do sesshin.
I think I will never learn that.
And it's, but it's so, if you taste just a few minutes of when it's really still, it can keep you coming back for years. It is so cool. And I think other people can probably speak up for this. It's just like, just this, you know, even though, even if like, you know, 90% of the session is like, I'm tired, I'm sore, what am I doing here? But then there's just like, and almost like, it often happens in a way because we just kind of give up. Like, what else are you going to do? If you keep trying, if you keep thinking about time, if you keep thinking, you just like, ah, you're so exhausted. You just, and then there's, so some reason the mind will just drop into this still place where it's just the sunlight on the floor. And you just think, this is the most beautiful moment I've ever experienced. There's absolutely nothing lacking. We should sit session all the time. Which is like,
And
don't.
then a few minutes later, you're like,
And then a
no,
few
we
minutes
shouldn't.
later, but then, and then you, and then a few minutes later, it's not like that anymore. And you're like, I want to get that back. How do I get that back? And you don't get, doesn't come back the whole retreat. But it's, you know, yeah, something you keep working on.
Thank you.
All right, John.
Oh, I lowered my hand because you kind of answered it. But my question was, so what is it that makes you feel that that's truth? You know, when you experience that during the experience and then after the experience, that it's like, yeah, that has way more validity than everything else I experience. Maybe you could just kind of go into that briefly.
Well, if you put your awareness in your hand, how do you know that's your hand? That's how you know. Other thoughts, comments, questions? So I'm not going to talk about the middle chapter where he talks about theories of mind and body. I thought that was probably a big giant rabbit hole that we don't need to go down. I'm prepared for that one. It was interesting, but so in chapter 28, a Bodhidharma side, encountering the dark night, kind of dark night of the soul, kind of thing. Which I don't know, I find it interesting that he placed this chapter here for this Oxfording picture. It really could have been placed anywhere in the book and might have been kind of more appropriate with one of the earlier Oxfording pictures. But he starts by telling the story of our Zen master, Huayka. So Bodhidharma was the teacher who went from India to China, according to our Zen mythology, India to China. There was already Buddhism in China, but he brought Zen or Chan. And then Huayca is his first Dharma student, Dharma disciple. So Bodhidharma's off meditating in a cave for years and years. And Huayca wants to him to teach him. And the story goes like the Bodhidharma is not paying him any attention. So it's this koan says, our founding ancestor was facing the wall when the student of the intimate way, Huayca, standing in the snow, cut off his arm, presented it to the master, and said, my mind is anxious. I beg you, teacher, please set it at rest. Bodhidharma replied, bring me your mind and I will set it to rest. Huayca wailed, I have searched thoroughly and I cannot find it. The founding ancestor responded, I have set it completely at rest for you. And then Huayca understood. Interesting, James Ford, he starts with a version of this story where I don't know if he made it up or if it comes from somewhere, but kind of tells the story of Huayca growing up and searching for many years, ordained early as a monk, and then he comes to Bodhidharma. And he keeps on knocking on Bodhidharma's door. Finally, the old teacher opens the door. And then I don't know, he had a razor and cut his arm. He didn't cut it completely off, I guess. It's a kind of extreme Zen story. But as Ford says, he says about this story, history, dream, folk story, the details don't really matter. What matters is that question. And Huayca has a question. It comes to him as anxiety. He feels it in his heart as a flutter. It hangs at the end of everything he does or thinks. Aitken Roshi, in his commentary on this case, tells us this is a treasure of the path disguised as sheer misery. The Roshi continues, suggesting this treasure is found in all religions worthy of the name. It is called the dark night of the soul. Huayca had no choice but to enter this dark night. And Aitken Roshi says, we have no choice either. If we enter the spiritual way, the intimate way, and we give ourselves to this path, it will take us to this place. This is where our journey brings us. It is the opening of our hearts into the mystery, but it starts hard. It is hard. It is a confrontation with our mortality. Actually, it is a confrontation with the mortality of the stars as well. All things, in fact, do fall apart. It is a dangerous moment, and we have to be careful. Here, we need to engage our practice of presence and extend it from formal meditation into every single aspect of our lives, waking, working, everything. And then there is the moment. It may come as a thief in the night. It may unfold like a flower blossom. There are many ways as there are people. Here we're invited into a new place, a spring from which life-giving waters flow. When we realize there is no source, that things arise and fall, and then we look deeper into yet deeper into that know of things, magic happens. The world that was so tightly held is set free. So, have you experienced a dark night of the soul or not? Whether or not you have, I again, this is kind of one of those things. It's just kind of important to talk about, because you, some of us might be experiencing that. We might have experienced that. We might experience that in the future. So, knowing that this is included in our path. I wouldn't say it's inevitable. Everybody's karma is different. It's not inevitable that you kind of come to this place. But you may. And it's not a sign of failure. It's not a sign of spiritual failure. It is a sign, like you said, it's or it depends on what you do with it, right? It is dangerous, like you said, in the sense that it may make you give up the spiritual path. It may make you conclude you're going about this wrong, or it, who knows? It may drive you into despair or depression or overwhelm. But if you, and it's ideal if you already have a strong practice when you experience this, if you practice anyway, it ha can essentially be a gateway. So when I talk about bodhicitta, I talk about it being composed of the three things: great doubt, great faith, and great determination. So this kind of dark night of the soul thing can be our great doubt. You know, you may come to a place where, all right, all this Zen stuff has been kind of nice, and you know, the precepts are nice and all that. But it's not filling the void in your soul. It's not like a, you know, magic pill you take that gives you the answers. You may wonder whether, I don't know, all that it promises is even possible, or that it's possible for you. And I mean, if you're somebody who looks at your life and just feels great gratitude and joy, that's wonderful. Many of us, at least at points in our life, look at our life and think, really? Is this it? Is this all it's going to be? You know, like what is deeper? What is more meaningful? As you will know if you've read my spiritual story, I definitely had this experience for probably, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say, like, when does it begin and when does it end? And it's not like when I was experiencing it, I was like morbidly sad the whole time. But I don't know. I would say it went on for at least a few years. I don't know. God, 5 seems a little long, but it went on for quite a long time. Where even though I was practicing, I was already ordained as a monk, I was living at the Zen Center, you know, great teachers. Surrounded by this practice, but I don't know, everything seemed really bleak and tasteless. Life didn't seem to have any point. I mean, I didn't feel like I had awakened any of this great shit, so like, I don't know. I just felt just miserable and sad. And I kind of thought, like, you know, people would knock on the door of the Zen Center, and I'd be like, make sure somebody else answered, because it shouldn't be the one to answer. You're like, yeah, run now while you still can, right? Like, but to go, essentially to go into that. Not just try to, you know, numb your way out of it, medicate your way out of it, seek refuge in alcohol and distractions or whatever. To really go into it and endure it means to face your greatest fears. Just really become intimate with your greatest fears, which, you know, at the heart, like he said, is basically just like dying and misery and not existing, and you know, just they're pretty fundamental fears. to face those greatest fears and come out the other side. So, I don't know. I guess I'll not open it up. I mean, if anybody else is experiencing that or has, I mean, I it's the 'cause it's not something that people often really want to talk about. If you're willing to share your experience, that would be it would definitely be valuable to others. Or you can just ask questions of somebody who has had this dark night of the soul with me. Isaac.
I'll give it a shot. Hello, everybody. For me, I think that's what actually drove me to practice was that feeling of the dark night of the soul. So even talking about it right now is a little bit of a challenge. So I think I fell into it probably about 7 years ago, 8 years ago. When I was really overloaded with work and family obligations, and I would just get to this point where I just felt completely disconnected from everything. And it was like a sense of emptiness, but it was really, really difficult. So, kind of like you said, it's interesting that the chap this chapter came after the chapter that you talked about first, because coming to Brightway, that has really like practicing with a Sangha has really opened up my practice in a way, and I've had very different experiences. And I actually haven't had that experience to that degree, like to a significant degree, since I've been practicing with Sangha. So, and I think maybe by trying to do it on my own, maybe I was kind of stuck in some stuff that I didn't have to be for so long. But it took a lot for me to be willing to actually show up and keep showing up. Yeah, that's all I have.
Thank you very much for sharing. Yeah, I think this chapter should be back like at the first ox herding picture. Or maybe it was as you're like you've got the ox by the rope and but you're still fighting with them, right? It kind of to me belongs back in that sense of real struggle. Not after you've tamed the ox, Anyway, doesn't really matter. Leah.
Yeah, so in my 20s, I had a depressive episode in college, which I have since learned in terms of mental health, that's the time that it commonly happens. If you're going to have some sort of major mental break, it's going to happen in college. Because the mind is fresh, still developing and everything. Anyway, so I had a major depressive episode in college and I was hospitalized for it, medicated for it. And I still remember what it felt like to be depressed with a capital D, to be really on the edge and just be staring into a well of just nothingness and nothing has any meaning or point. And I'm just going to die anyway. I mean, gosh, I hate to go there again. I'm not, but yeah, so it's interesting because when I look at this, I think that, and I have thought of this before, like what would it have been like? It's just a, you can't, don't, can't, woulda, coulda, shouldas don't work in the real world. I know this, but just as a thought experiment, I think about what would have been like had I had Zen practice during the time that I went into a depressive episode. Would that have been a tool I could have used to get out of it? Would it have influenced me in any way? I don't know. But I do know that when you're in a major depressive episode, the thing to do is ask for help and get medicated. I don't think I would have been able to get out of it by my, I don't know, but it's just a word of like, there's a difference between, I'm having a major mental health break to I am finding a new way forward with Zen practice. Like it could have helped, but it is a very different, unique thing experienced. And in a way, I'm glad I experienced it because now I know what it looks like. Now, when other people have been there or are going there or are in there, then I can recognize it. So it's been good in that way.
Thank you for sharing. My own teacher, Gyokuko, I mean, the way that she describes it is she just, she just has a depressive tendency. It's got that kind of thing, like she expects to have it for the rest of her life. And similarly, when she was younger, she had a really difficult time. And she said medication helped her practice. Right. And I think of it sometimes like you, but that also that like she has not, well, I mean, last I've heard anyway, she had not been on medication for many, many years. Right. And attributed that, at least in part, to practice. But she sees it as like, sometimes you fall into a deep enough hole, you gotta have some help. Just to reach a level where you can practice. But it's like, yeah, it's not all that either or, right? We do have some influence, and yet, availing ourselves of whatever support we possibly can. Not like I'm gonna do this through pure practice. And there is probably a, I don't know. I mean, if someone is prone to depression or anxiety, I'm imagining that can get involved with this dark night of the soul. It can flavor it. I've myself felt like what I experience is despair, and I differentiate that. It's not a psychological term, but I think it should be. It's not depression, where everything gets kind of dampened down and like just kind of numb and dissociated and kind of paralyzed and stuff like that. People have described it to me, but I felt j like just as bleak and hopeless, and it was kind of more of an acute angry thing. So I that's what I felt. And maybe it didn't need medication. Maybe it could have benefited from it. But yeah, it's a so they're probably not, it's probably like a Venn diagram, right? That there's these like mental health experiences that we have, and then there's kind of this spiritual crisis stuff, right? And they can overlap. Not so isn't they're not the same thing, but I could see them. Them overlapping. Hannah. You're still muted.
Okay, how about now?
Yep, we're good.
So yeah, my dark night of the soul. I literally actually died last summer. And it like just totally shook the foundation of my existence. Like, I mean, I guess before I would have, called myself a really resilient person, but I just like really set me into this pit of like, don't know, just hopeless despair of like everything we're conditioned to believe is important in life is kind of bullshit, which, gives you all these questions about, well, what does it mean to live a good life? And like, who you are and how you fit into the universe. And as both of those things change over time, like, yeah, so.
I I don't understand why people, more people, aren't feeling the dark night of the soul. Honestly, I mean, but I mean, I'm glad, and I have utter faith, and I can assure all of you that if you keep practicing, that there is a way out of it. There's a different way of relating to life and being, which does not depend on all that conditional stuff. It can celebrate the conditional stuff. You can be grateful for whatever health and good fortune we have, but it's oriented towards something much deeper, which, I mean, it takes a while to find, but it's saved my life. It definitely saved my life. Thank you for sharing. Yeah, I mean, and if you don't feel grim, if you had a dark night of the soul, like I said, karma is complicated. Who knows? But there was a point of like, it is partly dependent on our experiences, like yours, Hannah. It's a Dogen, our great Zen ancestor. I said I think his father had died early on, and then he lost his mother when he was 8. And he was at his mother's funeral, and he was watching the in smoke from the incense waft up. And he just, I don't know, he just had this, epiphany that everything is just so ephemeral that it set him on his spiritual path. And I was 3 and a half when I almost lost my mom. As I was growing up, I didn't think that had an impact on me until my niece was 3 and a half, and I realized, wait a second, I may not have totally understood what was going on, but like I probably had never been separated from my mom for more than a few hours, and now she's like gone for 2 weeks. And like I think they said they did bring me to the hospital to see her once, and they regretted it. And so all through my childhood, I would kind of had a morbid fantasy about being in school, and they would come and knock on the door, and they'd call me out of class to tell me my parents were dead. And I mean, I wasn't like I was just kind of morbidly fascinated by this. I wasn't like upset and like miserable and crying when I thought about this. I was just more just like, always just had this very real sense, all of this looks great, and I could be gone like that. And so I looked around at people, and I'm kind of like, people, don't you realize what's going on? Don't you realize how ephemeral this life is? Like, what? Isn't anybody upset? Isn't anybody? And so I started asking, like, what is the meaning of life? What is this? What are we doing? And I kept on asking that question. I got no good answers except in books, like could read Walden or something like that. And it felt like, okay, there's some human beings have thought like this, but I hadn't met any of them until I encountered Zen. And I finally encountered Zen when I was just 24 years old. I was very fortunate. And then suddenly here's people who are examining their lives, examining life. What does this mean? What does it mean to live a good life? What is really true? That's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So, I guess we'll leave it there. Any last questions or comments?
Tell me, is there one more lesson, I mean, Dharma talk on for this book?
Is it one or two? It must be two, because there's two more Oxfording pictures.
Yeah, because I thought there was one after tonight. And I love the symbolism, and when you read, you know, actual his verbiage, it's really very, it's very sweet. I mean, it's simple in the sense of easy to take in, mm-hmm. almost poetic. And yet, the symbolism, I think, we don't just have one ox in life. I mean, and it can come up at different times. We're not, and sometimes everyone's ox, so to speak, path is different, as you said, and different in different times in our life. So I think maybe the ox isn't really so young and energetic, and it doesn't even seem like a trial or a task. So I like the, but I think it must not be a one-time thing, because we're always, I think, finding new paths, I mean, new horizons, I feel. I think I can say that because I'm old, but I like the symbolism. Thank you for this.
Yeah, thank you, Ruthann. You just made me think of, like, well, you know, and then you search for the ox and you tame the ox and you forget the ox and whatever. And then, like, then you go, I don't know, you go searching for the ostrich and find the path of the ostrich, and you come into relationship with them and collect a whole menagerie. All right. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All but us throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, mahaprajna paramita.
Good night, everybody.
Night.
Hey, Josh.
Yeah.
Sweet dream.
So.